Welcome back, Nod Pod. Thank you guys so much for joining me for another episode of Chasing Heroin. And before we even get into the episode or do anything else, I just have to say thank you guys so much from the bottom of my heart. Like from the moment that episode released, I was getting DMs from you guys, emails from you guys, just like words of support for me and Skylar. And it was so touching and moving and helpful for me to feel that support and to feel that like nobody was judging me or the situation or him. And it was so uplifting to hear and to have. I cannot thank you guys enough for the messages that I got. And with regard to that, so I do actually have at the moment like a pretty positive update. So when I recorded it, I did say a few times, like at the moment he's doing well, by which I meant, you know, I think he had like 5 days or something. And I wasn't, you know, I was reluctant to even say that because I felt like it would probably, you know, he'd disappear soon. You guys know how it goes, you know, but he didn't disappear. And we were trying to get him into a program. And some of you guys know this, if you've dealt with the situation, when you have insurance, you can go to rehab like immediately. But when you don't have insurance, it's very difficult to get into a program. And so we brought him to do an intake at like a county funded facility. And he got on the waiting list and we were calling every day, calling every day, calling every day. And then I released that episode like about what was happening. And during that time, he was like doing okay, you know, like he didn't have a phone or anything. So he was just kind of like hanging out and getting better and, you know, healing and, you know, because he was like fucked up when I got him. You guys know how it goes. You know, he hadn't eaten in a long time. He hadn't slept in a really long time. And so a lot of it was him just like slowly recovering and like getting his mind back. So that's what was happening. The day after I released that episode, I got an email and the subject was looking for Skylar through my Chasing Heroin podcast website. And at first I thought like, oh shit, I wonder if this is like a legal issue. And I opened it and it was the CEO of a company that, so every year there's a, what they call a skills contest in construction where different states, different unions will send people of different trades. So they'll send men and women from like HVAC, plumbing, electrical, carpenter, and they go somewhere and they have to build a house or like build a structure within a certain amount of time. And it's like a nationwide contest. And he went a few years ago and their team did really well. The team from San Diego did very well. And he was like the lead carpenter on the job. And so the CEO of that school, the San Diego chapter, reached out to me and she had been looking for him, knew he wasn't at his last job anymore, and his phone had been off, obviously. And she remembered me because I went with him, and she Googled my name, found the show, saw that episode the day it was released, and listened to it, and reached out to me and was like, this is common in construction, and I really want to speak to him, and I want Skylar to know that I want him to work here, and we will wait for him to get sober, like whatever that looks like. I want him to know that there is hope. He's incredibly talented. He really impressed me at the skills contest, both with his skill and knowledge, but also with like his demeanor and his intelligence. And it was just like this amazing email. And she was like, I want to talk to him because I think there's a place for him here. Can you guys believe that? So he calls her the next day and we actually went in. She wanted to like chat with both of us, which I appreciated. And we went in and spoke, and long story short, he actually has a job there now and has started. At the moment, he has 33 days clean and sober as of this recording and started his new job on Monday. So we will see what happens. And he was on the wait list for the program. We were calling every day and there was no end in sight to that because we were thinking, well, maybe you go for 30 days and then start. But we ended up deciding, you know, this is a great opportunity. Like she's well aware of what happened at the last place. And, you know, if this opportunity is presenting itself and it's really great, like what the position actually is, it's very well suited to him and his skill sets. So that's where we're at so far. So far, so good. Thank you guys so much for your support. I know that all of this is risky. I know that all of this could go away, but so far, you know, not to sound cliche, but like, you know, one day at a time, that's where we're at. So anyways, thank you guys so much for your support. And I got to decorate for Halloween this year. I don't know why that's related. Well, it's kind of related because last year we were in our beautiful new house and he was so fucked up and I was so stressed out that I wasn't like buying, you know, plastic pumpkins to put around the house. And this year I was like, can we go together to like get some lights and stuff? And he was like, yeah. So I set up my house for Halloween. I'm like so happy about it. That's like one of those things when I was using too that I always wanted, like Halloween in particular, I always had like a great idea for a Halloween costume, but I was loaded and could never do it. Like I had like the perfect Tinkerbell costume picked out and I was always using. And so like, I never made it, you know, before I know it, it's October 30th. And I'm like, oh fuck, I didn't put anything together. And then as soon as I got clean in those first years, I started like really kind of going all out for Halloween for my costumes. And at the studio, we would always do a Halloween costume ride and I would dress up. And it's like, to me, it also represents like being clean and able to actually like take action on something like that. I always wanted to be like a lady that decorated her house, you know, and I decorated this year. So anyways, thank you guys so much for your support. So today's episode, I interviewed Sarah Boo 72. Sarah Boo is her name online on TikTok and on Instagram. Her story is amazing. She has 8 years. She is an attorney and she went from junkie to lawyer, went from heroin addict to lawyer on her own, you know, detoxed, got herself back into college, got herself into law school. She's now married and they're homeowners and they have a family. And I had such an amazing time talking to her. She's hilarious. And it's really such an empowering story because like, that I wouldn't have thought was possible, actually, like just because she'd been arrested a bunch of times too. And I'm like, can you be a lawyer if you've been arrested? But she said, yeah, you can. Because really what they look for is like, is it a question of ethics? So like if you've been arrested for fraud, that may prevent you from passing, you know, from being able to whatever it's called, like not pass the bar, but be allowed to be a part of the bar in whatever your state is. So I think it depends on the charge as well. And she had a bunch of possessions and her mugshots are all on her social media, which is why I want my mugshots, San Diego. Anyway, I think that's a lost cause because now it's been more than 10 years. I really wanted those mugshots. Do any of you have connections with cops in San Diego? Can somebody get me my mugshots? I want my mugshots more than just about like anything on this earth. Anyway, she's got her mugshots online and she's a lawyer now. And it's just the coolest story. You guys are going to love her. And thank you guys for, you know, giving me a little bit of a break and sticking with me while I took my break. And I hope you enjoy the show. As always, please reach out and let me know what you think. Thanks. So I've watched some of your stuff. But a lot of the meat and bones of your story, I didn't want to know because I wanted to be able to like hear it organically. So I know a little, but not everything. So why don't you just start us from the beginning and let us know, you know, who you are, where you're from, and how you got started using.
Okay. Sorry, my husband is texting me.
Okay, you're fine. No, answer.
LJ, you can take it, but it doesn't have gas either.
It's like whispering at the door, check your phone. And my friend says, I don't want to get gas. Can I take your car? I'm like, yeah, but I don't have gas either.
Love that you just said that. And to be honest, I might actually leave that in the show because that was hilarious. That is a conversation my husband and I would have. Like, oh, I have gas. I don't want to stop. Well, I don't have any either.
Okay. So my name is Sarah. I was born and raised in Oklahoma. My mom is a normie. You know, she's a CPA and a type A personality. And my dad was a drug addict. He died when I was 18, but they split up when I was real little. And so it's kind of interesting because on one hand, I lived in like a totally normal household with a normal mom as the only child who signed me up for everything I wanted to do. And I was spoiled and all of this. But then on the weekends, I got to see a totally different world, right? Where my dad, sometimes he had a place to stay. Sometimes he was staying with other people. You know, sometimes he would have me knock on the door and ask if we could stay the night because he knew those people would say no to him, but they would say yes to a little kid, right?
Oh, wow.
There were times where I'd pack my bag and wait by the door and he wouldn't show up. And so I knew very early on what drugs and alcohol were, kind of, and like what they did. And I knew I never wanted to do that, you know? And so that was always... I was a goody good kid. I did not get in trouble. I followed the rules. You know, I was super honest until I wasn't. I mean, you know, and
what kind of drugs did your dad do? Do you know what was his drug of choice?
It was downer. So I think it started with like Quaaludes and stuff back in the day. Okay. I don't know if it started, but that was like, my mom says that was one of his things.
Okay.
But then by the time he died, he was doing OxyContin. And that was before they turned the OCs into OPs. And so he was getting a script of 90 a month. And you know how that goes. It's like, I would sell them to my friends so we could pay to get the prescription. And then he would run out early. And then I'd have to find people to buy them from. And, you know, I'm 16 doing this whole pill shuffle thing.
Wait, okay. So you at 16 were getting his prescription somehow?
Yeah. So I was helping him. I would sell a few of them to pay for them.
He would ask you to do that?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So you're in high school, getting pretty good grades, doing well. And your dad says to you, what, I need you to help me with this? This is my
first time he called. And I actually started drinking and stuff at like 15. But I had friends who were doing it way before me. You know, I feel like at 15, I'm like such a late bloomer. But I really did. I said no for a long time. No, 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 no. So I started experimenting with just beer and weed and the normal stuff. I remember so distinctly, he called me one day and he said, Sarah, do you know what Oxycontin are? And I said, yeah, I had a friend who would, she took them. That was her thing. And he said, well, could you find me any? And I was like, actually, these apartments that I had friends at were like kind of in the hood. And this guy just like 2 days before had come and been like, hey, anybody need Oxycontin? And we were like, no, you know? And I was like, actually, yeah, I do. And so I went over and knocked on that apartment door and that guy sold me like 10 Oxycontin. That was the one and only time he sold them to me. I used to knock on the door at least once a week and I never found that guy again.
Oh, wow.
And my dad lived like 45 minutes away. And so I got in the car and drove to him. And that was like the beginning of it.
Whoa. And then, what was your relationship like with him? Were you like wanting to like make him happy and like connect with him? And you think that's why you did that? Did you guys have a good relationship?
So it was weird because it was like, he was very strict. Like, I remember the first time he saw me with my, like my belly button showing and he like freaked out and was like, absolutely not, you know? But he was strict on me. You better never smoke cigarettes. You better never do this. You better never do that. But old dad needs this. So can you, you know, and I was so codependent. I just wanted to make him happy that I probably would have done anything. And I've said this, it took me a long time after he died to be able to say this out loud, but I don't know if I'd be sober today if he was here, just because I think he'd be living in my house. I think my husband would have already left me. I think, or my dad would have ran him off. You know, I wouldn't have been able to say no to him. And so I think everything happens for a reason. And, you know, he died when I was 18 and it still took me a while to get sober, but I am able to keep it now.
So did you do drugs with him? Is that how you got started? You started doing oxys with him? No, you just got him some.
No, no, no. Yeah. And he never knew. I mean, my mom told him a couple times that I had done things and I always was like, well, I just tried it. And he's like, it's okay to try it. Just don't keep doing it. One time he did give me a Xanax because I was freaking out because a pill deal had gone wrong where I took this dealer with me and he said, you know, I'll sell these to you at this price if you give me some. And we got there. I told my dad, I'm like, all right, I got to give him two. And he's like, no, you got to give me two because I'm the one who hooked it up. And so anyways, they start arguing and I start freaking out and I'm like, I'll just pay for both of you to get two. It's not that big of a deal. And my dad was like, here, and gave me a Xanax. He's like, calm down. We'll figure it out. But that was the only time that he ever allowed me to, or pretended like he even knew. I think he probably knew, you know, but
yeah. Did he work? Did he have a job this whole time? Or
so when I was little, he went back and forth from being like a painter, like painting houses and stuff, to being a chef. He was a really great cook. And he had a couple like high profile jobs. Like one, I mean, he had the story where one time he cooked for the Dallas Cowboys, the whole team. But my mom also says that she thinks he probably had ADD or ADHD. And so it was like, he was brilliant and he was an excellent painter. He could mix colors and like match woods. Everybody's talked about that. His food was incredible. But like the business side of it, like my mom says, he would decide he's going to do this paint thing. They would get all the, they would buy all this equipment and sprayers and blah, blah, blah. And he would go quote a job, you know, I'm going to do this job in 3 days for X amount of money. And then, you know, 14 days later, he's not finished with the job. So now he's spent more driving to and from and all that. She says he gets started and then he has to run to the store and then he gets started again. And, you know, he just struggled with life.
So when did you start using, or how did you start using, and what age?
So I was 15 and I had, you know, several groups of friends, which I think this is common for us people in addiction or recovery. I think looking back, like I didn't know who Sarah was. So I just could kind of like pretend to be who I was around. So I could pretend to be with the smart kids, or I could pretend to be with the preppy kids, or I could pretend to be with the partying kids. And so that's what I did. And on the weekends, I had friends who would drink and smoke and at lunch. And I was always like, no, 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 you know, not me. I'm a goody good. I don't want to do that. And I don't know why I said yes the first time I did, but I was 15 years old and my friends had this shed in the backyard. And so we would all go like hang out in this shed. It had like a couch and they'd play music and the sister would buy alcohol. And, you know, I had been in the shed a million times and I always said no. And I don't know why I said yes when I did, but I did. And I used to be like, and all of a sudden I was cool enough and smart enough and pretty enough. I could run faster and jump higher. But looking back, I don't think that was even it. I think it was the first time in my life that I didn't care. I didn't have to think about, am I cool enough? Am I pretty enough? Am I smart enough? You know?
What was the first, were they smoking weed or that was drinking? That was alcohol?
Yeah, that was alcohol.
Okay.
It was 99 bananas. It was disgusting.
Dude, how do we all drink? I mean, I guess it's like, I don't think I've ever asked anybody else this question. My first alcohol was Mad Dog. I don't even know if that's a, because I'm older than you, so I don't even know if that's like a thing anymore, but it was Great Mad Dog. And it's like this disgusting, great flavored malt liquor. And then there's like 99 bananas. I guess the reason we all do that early on is because it's high alcohol volume concentrate for cheap. And then maybe, you know what I mean? That's what someone is either like stealing, because like that 99 banana shit is like near the register, or somebody's buying it for you, someone's brother, sister, like you said, and it's cheap. Because we all start, like no one starts on like Heineken. You know what I mean? We're all drinking the same bullshit. Isn't that weird?
Jack Daniels or,
Yeah, exactly. Something kind of nice.
Yeah.
So you started drinking.
That was it. And then, I don't know, shortly after that, at some point I tried weed. And then what really set it off for me was that I tried Xanax. And it's, you know, I've heard this a million times. It's like I had all these invisible lines in my head. And one by one, I just stepped over them. I'm never going to smoke cigarettes. I'm never going to drink beer. I'm never going to smoke weed. I'm never going to take a pill. And it's just like, you know, until you're at the point where it's like, I'm never going to steal from my mom. I'm never going to lie to the people I love. I'm not, you know, and you just keep doing it. And so I remember the first time I took Xanax and it was just the, I mean, I think because I was wound tight and I was so worried about what people thought that it would just helped me to not. And so that's what I started doing in high school still.
Xanax?
Taking Xanax. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Xanax was never my thing. Did you snort them or eat them?
So in high school, I ate them. And then once I got older, I started snorting them.
All right, snorting them. Okay. Did you end up finishing high school? Did you graduate?
I did. So I'm young for my grade. And so I graduated when I was 17. And my grades were always like kind of decent. I mean, I was able to kind of keep things. What was not okay for me was my attendance. You know, and I would make up lies and my mom would believe it. And then she would go to the school and tell them they were wrong because her perfect daughter would never lie to her because I've been honest my whole life, you know. And I think they were just so tired of me and my mom's shit that they were like, all right, get her out of here.
That's like such a Southern mama though. And to me, Oklahoma's got the same qualities as the South, you know, like the dad with the exposed belly button. Like I remember when I was getting married, I sent my dad a picture of a wedding dress I wanted. And the designer's called Katie May. It's like this kind of draped back. And I didn't think twice about it. And I sent it to him and he called me and he was like, Jimmy, I need you to be a little like modest here. And I thought he meant price wise. And I was like, Dad, I'm going to buy my own dress, like whatever. And he was like, no, like you can almost see her bottom. And I was like, oh, I didn't even know what he was talking about. I was like, it didn't even like occur to me, you know, but there's like that Southern dad, that Southern mom thing. So you graduate from high school and then did you go on to college like right then or what did you do next?
Yeah. So my cousin grew up in a small town in Oklahoma. She had always had like horses and cows and I had gone and stayed with her and her siblings every summer. And so ever since we were little, we decided that we were going to have like a horse ranch someday. When I tell my story, I always say like, you know, we were going to be farmers basically, which thank God that didn't work out because I'm way too high maintenance to be a farmer. But I start getting arrested over the summer. I'm still 17. My mom
started getting arrested for like possession and stuff. Okay.
Yeah. Minor in possession, I think was one. And then I got in a fight with one of my girlfriends because we had taken too many Xanax. And yeah, so my mom comes and gets me. I turn in August, we move in at OSU, Oklahoma State University, because they had like an agricultural program. This is where we're going to go. My cousin and I get this dorm. My cousin, mind you, has never smoked a cigarette, never drank a beer, never had a boyfriend. Like she is literally, when you think of like a country cowgirl, that was her. Like she was with her horses all day, every day. And you know, she had four younger siblings that she helped raise and she was just like a good girl. And so we move in August. I turn 18 in September. My attorney kind of talked to the judge and said, look, she's turned over a new leaf. She was a minor when those happened, like let her pay fines. They kind of got rid of those charges. And in October, I end up getting kicked out of school because I get arrested twice in 1 week.
Oh no, what? Okay.
Yeah.
How did that happen? What happened?
So, I don't know why. I'm also like the type of person, like when I get fucked up, I want to drive around. I don't know why I do that.
No, dude, I used to do that too. Okay. So like my biggest solace was driving around in my car, smoking cigarettes, listening to, I don't know if this is what you did, but I would listen to, this is kind of sad, I would listen to sad music and like cry and smoke cigarettes, which is probably, you probably did like the fun version of that, which is have fun, which is what most kids do. But my parents were divorcing and I was like really sad. And so I would listen to like Matchbox 20 and the Goo Goo Dolls and smoke cigarettes and cry. So I get it. But anyways, okay, so you would get fucked up and drive around.
Yeah, and like sometimes we would get in the car and like drive to the lake, which is 2 hours away or whatever. And so anyways, this is like a small town, Stillwater, Oklahoma. And the first time they pull me over, I have beer in the back seat, minor in possession. They take me to jail. I'm 18 now. So my mom, I call my mom. She calls a bondsman who gets me out of jail. And then Thursday, my dad, he had gotten his prescription and he wanted me to sell them to someone that he had already ripped off. So I get the prescription and I take his name off of it. That way I can say it's not his, right? Well, I didn't know much about pills at the time. So I take them to the lady to sell and she's like, these are generic. I don't want them. They're not the name brand OxyContin. And I'm like, okay, give me through the weekend. I'm going to take them to Stillwater. I will sell them. And if I don't, I gave her a check and I said, if I don't have them by Monday, you can cash this check or whatever. So I go back to Stillwater. I smoke weed in my dorm. Thank God my cousin wasn't there, but I tried to smoke weed in my dorm. It's like a little bitty roach. Instead of like throwing it out the window, I put it back in my cigarette pack and I did all the things. Like I put the towel under the door and turned on the fan, lit the candle. And I don't know, somebody must have snitched on me because 10 minutes later, the cops are at the door.
Oh no.
Yeah. And they're like, someone said you're smoking weed in here. And I was like, no, I just smoked a cigarette. And they're like, well, can we search? You know, and I should have said no, which they had probable cause. They would have searched anyways. But yeah, they search and they find that bottle of pills. And I'm like, they're my dad's. Well, then why'd you take the name off?
Oh my God.
And then I also had Xanax in an Altoids can. And they were like, what are these? And I'm like, Altoids. Like, yeah, no. So they took me to jail.
Xanax doesn't look anything like Altoids. That's really funny.
Yeah. Yeah. So they take me back to the same jail and that I was just at 3 days ago. And I call my mom. And back then, I don't know if it's still like this, but because it was a small town, it's like if you go to jail Thursday, they bring you all to court Friday morning to see a judge. And so they take me into court in my oranges with my belly chains and everything. And my mom and my stepdad are there. My real dad is not there. And they pretty much were like, we will bail you out of jail if you go to rehab. And I was like, oof, jail or rehab? Like, I don't know which one is worse. Someone told me this rehab was like a 3-day evaluation. They're just going to make sure you're not crazy. So I agreed. So they take me to this house in the middle of nowhere for girls 18 and under. And I'm asking these girls, like, does the weekend count towards my 3 days? Because I got shit to do, you know? And they all started laughing. And they're like, Sarah, this is a 90-day program. You're not going home in 3 days.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So I white knuckled it for a week. And then I packed my bags and I hitchhiked back to Stillwater where I was living before.
Okay. And that lady cashed your check too, right?
I'm sure she tried. I didn't have the money in the bank anyway. Okay. So I don't know how that,
right, okay. Okay. And then also I have a different question. I have seen on TikTok. Okay. What year was this that you're talking about that you were in college?
2007 was when I went to college.
Okay. So I've seen this, like a couple of like memes and jokes about this. The 2007s, what's it called? The barred out years when you're like the zanny years for kids in the 2000s. Do you know what I'm talking about? It was like a whole thing where kids in the 2000s were doing Xanax and they've even termed it something. But I feel like it was kind of common because Xanax wasn't like, maybe it was a thing, but it wasn't something as that I ran into as much. Okay. So never mind. Yeah. I'll look
no,
it up.
I've never heard of it, but it's, okay. That is, yeah.
That's true though. Okay. Yeah. It's like a thing. It's like the generation, it's called like the bar generation or something. I'll look it up on TikTok and send it to
I'm
you.
I'm going to have to look too.
Yeah. Look it up. It's like the generations in the 2000s that were doing Xanax. Okay. Whatever. I'm going to have to look for it later, but I know it was like a whole thing. So anyways, I've seen TikToks about it. And you know, if it was on TikTok, obviously.
Yeah.
It's true. So anyway. Okay. So you get arrested twice in 1 week. You bail on rehab, you escape rehab, and then you went back to college? You went back to your dorm room, or where'd you go?
No, I went and stayed with a friend that is actually a boyfriend who lived in Stillwater, too, because I got kicked out of college. They wouldn't let me come back. But those girls told me before I left the rehab, they're like, you know, girls run away all the time. I don't know why I told people I was running away, but I did. And they're like, girls run away all the time. The cops always come get them, so, like, you can leave, but... Well, I didn't realize I was 18. I was not court-ordered to be there. Most of those girls were minors, you know?
Right.
And so I was so scared that I stayed sober for like 2 years because I thought the cops were coming for me.
Yeah.
So yeah, I got my 2-year degree. I got a job and like things were going well. And yeah. And then I decided that really Xanax was my problem and I can drink alcohol as long as I don't take Xanax. It'll be fine.
Also, in the meantime, your dad dies.
Yes. So my dad died. Let's see. I left like the first week of November in 2007. I left treatment and my dad died November 22nd. So like 2 weeks after I ran away.
You were probably so young and new in it. Did it affect you at all in terms of like, did you think that you were an actual addict or did you think you were young and having fun and you had bad luck and got caught?
Yeah, that's where at that point I still thought I was young and I was having fun. And then when my dad died, it was kind of a like wake up call for me. Like, holy cow, I got to get my stuff together. You know, like I need to stay on the straight and narrow. I need to. And I did. I went to school and, you know, did all the things that I was supposed to for a couple of years, which is so interesting to me because in total now I've been to treatment 8 times and I left early the first 7 times. And every time I left, I kept telling myself, you can do this. You stayed sober before. Remember, like you got this. And I really had myself fooled that like that was me. I did it, you know. And I have read about in 12-step literature about how like if someone has a reason to stop early enough in their addiction, that a lot of times they can. And it's just once it progresses, you don't have the same ability that you once did.
So. I did that too. I quit doing Coke for like 3 years once, but I was still drinking and smoking weed, but I'd had like a real problem with Coke. And so from like 22 to 26, I never did Coke again. And I forever after that would tell people like, no, 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 I'm not like an addict. I totally know how to stop because I did it once before. And that was something that was a rationalization that I took with me all the way until my detox at 32, however many years later, you know? So you decide that you can drink. Xanax was your problem. And then where do we go from there?
I started drinking a little bit and going to the bars with my friends and everything is okay at first. And then I got introduced to pain pills, which I had taken pain pills. I had tried them in high school when my friend was taking them, when my dad took them. And they just, I don't know, I didn't like them. And actually, when I say introduced, I got my wisdom teeth taken out.
Okay.
And so I was prescribed to them normally. And I don't know why, but, you know, they very quickly became my thing. And it went from like, I mean, you know how it is. Friday night, you take one Lortab, and the next Friday, you take two, and the next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, you take four, and next thing you know, you're taking them all day, every day, and when you don't have them, you start getting sick, and then it's like, holy cow, how did this happen? I didn't mean to get this far into it, you know?
Did you know you would get sick? I didn't know that you would get sick off opiates. Did you know that if you took them for some period of time, then you would get sick?
I did because my friend, the one I was talking about from high school.
And your dad too, obviously.
Well, yeah, yeah. But my friend, I remember her trying to quit a couple times and like she would come over to my house and she would just like all night get in the bathtub and get out and get in the bathtub. And I remember thinking like, why would you ever do a drug that makes you feel like that? What an idiot. Like I would never do that. But they snuck up on me because I remember I was only taking Lortabs. I was only taking them a few times a week, you know, or one or two here and not, I guess I was taking them more. I must've been taking them almost every day, but I called that same friend and I was telling her about a fight I got in with someone. And she was like, you know, you're having withdrawals. And I was like, what? And she was like, yeah, they start with irritability. Like you're being irritable, like, because the reason you're mad is so stupid. And I was so mad at her. I was like, I'm not having withdrawals. You know, because in my mind, like withdrawals mean you're a drug addict. And I was like, that's so stupid. No way. So
what were you doing for work during that time?
I worked at a hotel. So when I moved back from Stillwater from college, I got a job at a hotel and I stayed there for a couple years. And then I don't remember. I just had odd jobs here and there. Like at one point I worked for a nonprofit. At one point I worked for just like in an office building. But I would keep a job for a few months and then I would fall off and they would fire me because I couldn't show up or whatever.
So when does your addiction progress to heroin? So you're doing pills, it's creeping up on you, you're getting sick. When do you progress to heroin?
So I was 22 years old. So I was about 20 when I started taking the pills regularly. And I was 22. At that point, I had been taking the OxyContin, you know, and they quit making the good OxyContin. And so they were getting harder and harder to find. I couldn't find any one day. I was getting sicker, you know, and I had been calling around. Nobody had any. I called this guy that I had known since I was young. And he said, I can't get you any pills, but I can get you some heroin. And I hung up on him because I was like, I'm not a junkie. I would never do that.
Totally. I think that's everyone's first response. Maybe not everyone, but I think that's commonly people's first response when they hear heroin. And I feel like it's important for other people to know that. Like if you know a heroin addict and you can't believe that they're on heroin, they probably can't either. You know what I mean? The average human being, when they hear heroin is like, it's the worst one. You know what I mean? There's so much connotation with that. The implications with that are really dark. So He said, I have heroin. You hung up.
Yeah. And for years I had said I would never do heroin. I mean, number one, because it's gross, but number two, because I would love it. I know myself well enough to know I would love it. So I couldn't find any pills. I called him back a couple hours later and I, you know, sold myself this lie. I'm just going to do it this one time. Tomorrow I'll get some pills and everything will go back to normal. But you know how that ends. Like, it's like trying to put the toothpaste back in the tube. You know what I mean? There's no going back. There's no spending more for less after. And he showed me how to use a needle that night.
Oh, he did. So the first time you did it, you shot up. Yeah. Oh, shit. Okay. All right. Fuck. Okay.
And like a week late, or it might have been the same night, with either that night or a couple nights later, he takes me to the guy he's buying it from. And he takes me inside. Pretty much he was like, come in and flirt with this guy to get this for us cheaper. You know, and so that was his first mistake, was taking me. He was also using my phone. So he's using my phone and takes me in to introduce me to the guy. And a week later, the guy has moved in with me.
Oh, no. And
now I am stuck with a dope dealer. And I was stuck with him until he went to prison a few years later.
Like together, or he was just living at your house?
No, we were dating.
You were together.
Yeah. Okay. And at the time, like, I loved him and I would have told you, like, this is for real. And, you know, and I don't ever want to, like, trash anybody else. I just think that we were both so messed up at the time that, like, how can you love someone when you're not even in your right state of mind? You know what I mean?
Totally. Totally. So what do those years look like before he goes to prison?
So I got sober when I was 25. So between 22 and 25, it was just a whirlwind. And
how did you have an apartment?
I had a house, actually. So when I moved back to Oklahoma City after I ran away from treatment and I was, you know, I was doing well. I was had my 2-year degree and was working and like everything was going well. My mom helped me buy a house.
Oh, all right.
So I owned this house. Yeah.
Oh, shit. Okay. So you owned a home. Were you still paying a mortgage on it and stuff, or did you own it outright?
No, we were paying. I was paying on it and everything.
Okay.
It got to the point where she helped me because I couldn't. Okay. At first I was doing fine, but then, yeah. And it wasn't like a huge nice house or anything, but still it was mine and it was awesome and I could move people into it. And
like your heroin dealer boyfriend.
Yeah, exactly. And my poor mom, man, so over the next 3 years before I got sober, I went to treatment 7 times. I had already been once and I went 7 more. Those charges that I got in Stillwater, you know, I got deferred sentences. I had stayed sober. Everything was great. Those went away. I started getting new charges. I got 3 charges in 1 year. I totaled multiple vehicles. I ended up in the hospital at one point for shooting bad dope. Like, it was just a whole whirlwind. And my mom, she was taking me to get hair follicle tests and I was passing them. And she, you know, really was like Googling different mental illnesses. And like, she had no idea what was wrong. My stepdad kept telling her, she's high. And my mom was like, no, she's not. She's passing drug tests. And he was like, I don't care what she's passing. She's high.
How were you passing hair follicle tests?
I did all this research and I had this whole like routine. Basically, they sold this stuff at the smoke shop and I would use that and I would use vinegar and Dawn dish soap and you have to buy a new brush every time and use new hair ties. And I had this whole thing and my mom thought these were random, right? So she didn't know until years later that I would do all this stuff to my hair and I would leave it wet or I'd like put it in a braid or something. And she would come get me and we'd go have lunch. And I, being the amazing, upfront, honest daughter that I am, would be like, hey mom, while we're out, let's go get a drug test.
Oh my God.
She'd be like, that's great. So I don't have to ask Sarah. She's going to volunteer to do it.
That was pretty smart on your part.
Yeah, she didn't know. I had prepped myself.
Yeah. Oh shit. Okay. Okay. You're one of the only other people that I've ever met. I got super, super good at passing pee drug tests, but that's pretty easy to figure out for women. Like, you don't have to be like rocket scientist to figure that out.
Yeah.
The hair thing, that's pretty impressive. So you're passing those and he knows that obviously something's up. Were you on your mom's health insurance? How were you going to treatment?
Yes. Well, okay. Yeah, I was, because I up to 25, I think I was still on the same
one. Yeah, you can be on it up to 26. And so sometimes I always like to ask, because like, it's so hard to get into treatment when you don't have insurance. And I feel like people will hear you say that. And they're like, see, you can go to insurance, you can go to rehab. And I'm like, no, I promise you, she had insurance. Do you know what I mean? Like, people who are non addicts are like, pick yourself up by your bootstraps, go to rehab, there's resources available. And I'm like, not really. But you know, okay, so you're going to rehab all the time.
Yeah. And for years, like every time shit would get really bad or I'd be in a problem, I would call my mom and she would come get me and she'd buy me clean underwear, find me a treatment center, and she'd take me there to Arkansas or Texas or wherever. And thank God it got to the point where she just quit answering the phone. She started turning her phone off at night. The last time I called her to go to rehab, she didn't answer. And I text her and I'm like, Mom, I need to go to rehab. And she texts me back and said, that's cool. Call me when you get there. And I say this all the time. She saved my life by cutting me off. She quit paying for my attorney. She quit bonding me out of jail. She quit paying my mortgage. She quit doing all of that, you know?
I think that's so important that you just shared that. So did you find your last rehab on your own? Did she stick to that and you found it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And that was the only time I found it on my own.
Okay. And that was the time that it worked. And now you have 8 years.
Yeah.
Okay. So I know you were going to share, I always ask people to share some sort of like story. And this is a great time for you to share your story because you recently had surgery to deal with it. And again, like I started to listen to some of your videos. And by the way, you posted something, it was towards the beginning of your new TikTok account. That is one of the most profound things I've ever heard. Your video about Do It Scared. And by the way, there's a book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And so like the idea of Do It Scared, like that's sort of that's something I've heard. But you said, you took it further and said, everything I've ever done good, I did scared. So like that's evidence that doing things scared worked. I loved that. I liked it and saved it. And I was like, that was really smart. I'm going to ask her about that tomorrow. I loved that. But okay, so you recently had surgery to fix something that happened in your active addiction. And like the next video was you answering it. And I skipped out because I didn't want to hear it. Because I want to hear what happened to your booty.
Yeah. So I said a second ago, I spent a couple months in the hospital for shooting bad dope. And that is this. This was 2013, the end of 2013. I got sober in May of 2015. So keep that in mind. This was not even enough to get me sober. But I had been living with these random people. And, you know, my mom had cut me off at this point. I mean, she would talk to me sometimes, but like she would not give me money. She would not let me live with her. Like she had cut me off in that way. And so I have like this mosquito bite, which my veins were messed up because I had just ruined them very quickly. And so I started doing what we call muscling it. I don't know if all drug addicts, some people call it skin popping, I think, but it's where you just shoot it in somewhere with no vein. And so, I mean, it's a last resort because it doesn't get you as high, but when you're sick, you got to do what you got
to
do.
I wanted to ask you that because I actually never muscled, but when you do it, okay, so you don't feel it as much as when you hit a vein, but it gets you well.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So it's not like instantly getting in your system like a vein does, but it still gets the job done. Yeah.
Does the job. Okay.
Yeah. So one day I'm in the parking lot of an AutoZone and I muscle it in my butt cheek, which is pretty common. Like arms and butt cheeks are the most common. And I remember that was so crazy because I like passed out and like you're not hitting a vein, so you shouldn't pass out, you know? And I was by myself and I wake up and I look around and I'm like, wow, you know, in my head, I'm like, wow, that must just be some really good shit. Cause like, how did it make me? I don't know. Anyway, so I just go on about my life. And I don't know, a few days later, I have like a mosquito bite. And I didn't really put two and two together that like that's where I had shot up, you know, but I had like a mosquito bite on my butt. And I'm like, that's weird. And I start feeling like flu-like symptoms where I like can't get up and I'm like tired. And I'm telling the people I live with, I'm like, and like every day it's getting a little bigger. And I'm like, this is so weird. And they're like, well, maybe you just hit your butt cheek with a doorknob. And I'm like, I think I would have remembered that. And I don't think I would feel like sick. So I started going to the hospital. I went to the hospital 3 times that week. And I told them, I'm an IV drug user. I don't know what's going on, but I need you to look at this. It started getting hot to the touch and stuff. And they just kept sending me home with antibiotics. They're like, oh, you're fine. You're fine. And so I think, I want to say it was like later, or I don't know the day. I just know it was like late at night one night, like 8 or 9 o'clock. And I call my mom and I'm like, Mom, I really need you to come look at this. I don't know if I'm okay. Like, I don't know what I said to get her there, but she comes over. And I didn't say all this on TikTok because it gets kind of gross, but it got to the point where there was like pus. And so I have on like full butt underwear and shorts and sweats and I sit on a towel and we drive like 20 minutes from where I was at to her house. And all of that is soaked by the time.
Oh my Lord. Okay.
And I mean, when it moves, it's like it sounds like a milk jug. It's just can tell something's wrong.
Yes.
And so my mom's like, you have to go to the hospital. And I keep telling her, Mom, I already went to the hospital. I'm fine. I just need to let the antibiotics kick in. You know, I'm still like this. I don't want to go to the doctor. I don't want to go to the hospital unless I have to. And she was like, no, we're going to the hospital. Like, I don't care what you say. So she takes me to the hospital. It turns out that I was already sepsis. The doctor said if I would have gone to sleep that night, I would have died.
Oh my gosh.
I was like 12 hours away from my immune system crashing. So they rushed me into surgery. They put a PICC line from my neck to my heart and they just cut out a whole half my ass cheek. So like muscle, tissue, everything. It was all like dead skin. And so they
Describe to me how big this is. With your hand. Like that big? Yeah. Okay.
No, I mean, I'm not going to pull my pants down, but it's like this big spot. They just take all of that out.
Oh my Lord.
It's almost like flat. So I still have like my real butt cheek here, but this is like flat.
Okay. It's like the size of a softball, y'all, is what she's describing if you're just listening to and not watching it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It was big. And so I was on a wound vac at first, which is basically just like a suction.
Did you get sick in the hospital or no? Cause they're giving you painkillers cause you'd had surgery.
Yeah. They were giving me painkillers and my doctor's son was a heroin addict. So he was giving me twice as much Dilaudid as a normal person because he understood like what tolerance was. And I was so grateful for that. He was so kind. He never made me feel less than, you know what I mean? I got really lucky there and I still was having people bring me heroin and I was putting it in my quick line. So, yeah. So I was there for a couple months. They ended up doing a skin graft. So they took skin from the outside of my leg and put it on my butt cheek, which the spot is like on the outside of the butt cheek. So it's almost like, it was almost like a huge hip dip. Okay. Like unless you saw it on the right angle, you would have never known.
Okay. You know? Even in like a bathing suit, you couldn't totally tell.
Oh, in a bathing suit, you would have been able to tell because the scar was too big. But I'm saying like in jeans or like normal pants, leggings. Like, unless you saw it at the right angle, you wouldn't have been able to tell. But because it was me, obviously, it was, you know, I was self-conscious.
Like, that must have felt awful to you, especially as, like, a woman. And these days, now it's, like, all about the butt, right? Like, that must have made you feel awful, like, in the years after that, you know?
Yeah, well, the craziest part of the story is that I didn't get sober. So I'm in the hospital for like 2 months, which by the way, if you've never made it in the hospital for long term, like that is a drug addict's dream. You're laid up 3 meals a day, cable TV. Totally. They're bringing you drugs to, you don't have to find a vein. They're putting it in the vein.
Totally.
My whole family felt sorry for me and were like, my mom was bringing me food every day. She was not mad at me anymore. Like it was amazing. Yeah. But she let me move in with her after that, she let me come home with her and she hadn't been letting me live with her, like I said. And, you know, they had the chaplain in there talking to me about how I was going to die if I didn't, you know, get it together. They almost amputated my leg. I couldn't walk hardly. I couldn't sit. You don't realize how much you use your butt cheek to like control your leg, to sit, to hold yourself up. Like, you know, so I was like, couldn't bathe myself or go to the bathroom or whatever. So she takes me home and with her. And before it was even dark, I had jumped the fence and was off and running again.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it took me another 2 years or maybe a year and a half, I guess. I mean, that happened in 2013. I didn't get sober till 2015. I mean, it's a funny story. The funny part being, you know, and I always say like, you know, for 10 years, I've been half-assing it.
Dude. I also saw one of the comments on your TikTok was so funny. It was the one with the pencil emoji and it was like, don't do drugs, we'll lose ass. I thought that was so funny. You responded to that one. I was like, oh my God, that's hilarious. Yeah. You know?
Some girl was like, I found you, Miss New Booty.
That's so true.
So yeah, the comments are funny, but I always like to point out too the fact that addiction is just cunning, baffling, and powerful. You know, it didn't matter that I had been laid up for months. It didn't matter that I almost lost my leg or my life or that my family was terrified or that I couldn't walk or use a bathroom or, you know, none of that stuff mattered. What mattered is like, I could not sit in my own skin long enough to even heal. You know, I just had to like go, go, go. I just couldn't stop.
So a year and a half later, you text your mom. She says, I can't help you. You find your own rehab somehow. Where was it relative to where you are? Was it in Oklahoma or where did you go?
It was in Texas. It was in Grapevine, Texas. It was like 3 hours away from where I live. And I had called all these treatment centers. Number one, will you take my insurance? Number two, will you let me smoke cigarettes? That was my only goal. And these people said yes. And so I told everyone, my friends and the treatment, everybody like, oh, tomorrow's the day. I said that for like a month. Tomorrow I'm going to rehab. You know how that is. And I ended up getting in a fight with the person I had been staying with and was in a shitty relationship with someone who's mentally, physically, emotionally abusive. And so I would leave for weeks at a time. And then when I would go back, we would get in knockdown, drag out fights. And so I was gone from there. I got kicked out of the other place in the middle of the night one night. And I was just like, I only really have one option, which is go to rehab. And so I did. And I promised myself on the way there in my head, I'm like, Sarah, all you have to do is complete treatment. You know, it's not going to work. You've already been 7 times, you know, you've read their stupid little book and you've been to their stupid little meetings and, you know, like AA and NA and all that, that works for people, you know, like old people who can't stop drinking, but it doesn't work for people like me. And I really thought that, but in my head, I was like, but you just have to complete treatment because you're going to end up in prison, and then your mom will feel sorry for you and she'll be like, oh, at least she tried, and she'll put money on your books.
Right. I think it's important that you say that because I also didn't believe at all the last time that I got clean that it would work at all. Like, I just was tired and I was like, I know this isn't going to work, but like, whatever, I guess I'll try it again anyways. But I have two questions before we talk about your rehab experience. One, you mentioned like fighting with a boyfriend. You seem like, I could be totally wrong. Were you like a fighter chick, like with other girls? Yeah. Did you get in fights? Okay.
Yes.
I get that vibe. So like, what kind of shit would make you, I totally feel that because I was not, I would have been very scared of you. I already know, like if we were in the same trap house, I would have been like avoiding you because I was like a little bitch and I would not have tried to fight you. So like, what would like make you fight someone? I can see you like picking a fight.
Anything really. And I was just talking about this with some friends today, and I talked about it with my therapist because I've had the same therapist since I was 17.
Oh shit.
And so she's seen me from
pills. She must be so proud of you.
To heroin, to sober, to lawyer, to all of it. And so she was like, I just remember like the aggressive teenage Sarah who like hated the world and hated everyone. And the truth of the matter was like, if I puff my chest up and act like a badass and scare you guys, then you won't ever know like how scared and insecure I am on the inside. You know what I mean? And that's what it was about. It was like, I only picked on people that I knew I could beat up. You know what I mean? I didn't go around picking on people who I thought could beat me up. I was a lot more aggressive when I had a posse with me, right? Because we're a lot more intimidating in groups. You know, and it was all a facade. I was scared to death. Anytime I got in a fight, I was terrified. But I just did it to look cool or feel cool or prove my point or, you know, you're not going to fuck with me or whatever. I don't know. It was so stupid.
Yeah. And then how did you get to the rehab? Oh, well, actually, another question. When you hit yourself in the butt in the AutoZone parking lot, were you in a car or standing in the parking lot?
I was in a car.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And then I was just curious. And then how did you get to rehab? Did you have a car still?
Yeah, I still had a car. That was the only thing. I had a car and I had health insurance.
Okay. And a phone.
And a phone. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And a phone. Okay. How did you have the car and the phone?
My mom still was paying for those.
Okay. Things. So she helped you with a couple of things.
Maybe not the phone. I don't remember the phone.
Or the car, maybe you owned outright and she paid the insurance or something.
Yeah, I do know she bought the car, and I don't remember if she was paying on it or what, but yeah. And I had, when I was younger, had these really nice, beautiful cars that my mom got for me. And, you know, I ended up in this little Hyundai, which I was so grateful for this Hyundai after I got sober, obviously, because, you know, I was able to drive myself to rehab and then to sober living. And I was able to drive myself to my job and pick up friends and go to meetings. And, you know, at first I was real hateful about the Hyundai because I was just an entitled, hateful, mean girl, you know, like in high school and until I got sober. But that changed a little bit because, and it's funny how God works, because it's kind of hard to be like an entitled, mean girl when you're homeless. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
So, yes, you know. Yeah.
So how long was the rehab that you went to?
It was 30 days.
Okay. And was it a 12-step based program or what type of program was it?
Yeah, it was 12-step based and it was Valley Hope. I don't know if they have those everywhere. They have a couple of them.
That sounds familiar, but I don't know. So did you detox? Like, how did they detox you? Did they do like the Suboxone tapered detox? Okay. All right. Over like 5 days or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to say it was like 9 days. I don't remember. But another thing about this rehab, though, is someone told me, and this was true, if you're over 25, I mean, you get to keep your car anyways, but you can leave for 2 hours a day. Like, you guys can sign out together and go to the Walmart or whatever, and you can keep your phone.
Oh, well, okay.
You have to be over 25, and I was 25, so I was not over 25. So I remember being so pissed. But honestly, it's probably, looking back, it was probably good for me because I didn't need to be out and about running the streets.
No, it is good. Like at the rehabs that I went to, they always put you on a blackout where they kept your phone for the first 30 days or longer. And the last one I went to, you got to keep your phone. And I was glad about that. But at the same time, I was kind of like, I don't really need to be on my phone texting people. Like, there was a couple of times when I was like trying to get somebody to bring me dope. You know what I mean? It's like, that's going to be really common if someone gets to keep their phone. So you detox. What's the day that you went into rehab?
I got there in the middle of the night on May 26, 2015.
And that's your clean date?
Well, May 27 is my clean date.
Oh, right. Okay. All right. Yeah. That's crazy. And you never used again. That's so crazy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. So you go there, you complete the program. And then where did you go after that?
I mean, every time I went to rehab and I left early, I had such good intentions. And I think that's important for people to know too, is like, in my head, I was going to stay sober 100%. Hook me up to a lie detector. I swear to God, I'm going to stay sober. And then I leave early and I don't have a plan in place. And I end up going back to the same people, places, and things. And by the end of the night, we're celebrating me being sober by getting high. You know what I mean? And it's just this cycle of like, they didn't know how to stay sober. I didn't know how to stay sober. We had great intentions, but left to my own devices, I can't stay sober. And so I didn't go back to that boyfriend. We dated for a little bit, like a month after that. But instead of moving back in with him, I went to sober living. So I did like a phone interview while I was in treatment. And I went to that sober house. And that really changed my life too, which I had said for years, like, I'm not going to sober living. I'm not living with a bunch of bitches. I don't even like girls, you know, but it became like a sisterhood. I had a group of friends that, I mean, there's one girl who really became my best friend. And she introduced me to everyone she knew. She took me to all these meetings. I didn't have to go by myself and be alone. And honestly, I had been living like a wild animal. Like, there was no such thing as a curfew. There was no such thing as like being respectful or, you know, like I didn't clean, I didn't cook, I didn't do laundry. I didn't even brush my teeth every day. So like living in this house where we had a curfew, we had to do one chore a week, which was like do the dishes or something super simple. Like I needed that someone to hold my hand and like teach me how to be a grown up.
So did you start working when you got to the sober living?
I did. It took a little while to find a job because I had a criminal past now. Well, not just past, but like I was still going to court for some of these.
Okay.
And
were they felony charges? Did you have any felonies on your record?
I had two felonies and misdemeanor. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay.
And one of them I had been sentenced for and I had got like a deferred sentence and then I picked up two more. So I had this probation officer too. That was part of it. Like my family wouldn't talk to me. I was in and out of jail. I had this probation officer calling everyone, threatening to send me to prison, but I couldn't go see him because I couldn't pee clean. And I was just scared to go see him, I guess. And I don't know. It was just like the perfect storm when I went to treatment.
So where did you finally get a job when you got out?
This guy put this ad in Craigslist. And so I show up and it's like this little office in the middle of not really in the middle of nowhere, but it wasn't like an office area. It was like kind of a quiet area. And I go in and he's like, you know, it was like $8 an hour pay. And he was like, it's like 9 to 5. We take a 2-hour lunch. We're pretty chill. Like, do you think you can do it? And I'm like, yeah, sure. He didn't tell me what it was. And I was just like, okay, cool. And so, and in my interview, he goes, sometimes we have some drinks at lunch. Is that okay with you? And I was like, yeah, I don't drink, but you guys can. And he was like, oh, why don't you drink? And I was like, oh, I'm in recovery. I didn't tell him I was like, you know, 47 days clean or whatever. I just said recovery. So the next day I go back and he's like, okay, I'm going to teach you how to do this. So what we do is that we run background for employers. So we're going to run yours first. And I was like, okay.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And he was like, are we going to find anything? And I was like, yeah, you are. You know, like I've been in and out of jail because of drugs and alcohol. And that's what you're going to see. And, you know, I'm sober now and I'm really trying to turn over a new leaf. And so, I mean, he let me stay and he was cool as shit.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So he shows you how to run the background by being you and you see your record. And he's like, okay, you're starting anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's really cool. I feel like in recovery, like when we make some sort of internal shift where we like are wanting and willing for the first time to do the right thing, little weird miracles like that start happening where you meet the people in your life that you need to meet, you know, like I see it over and over and over again, you know? So you're working with him. And then when do you decide, I think I want to be a lawyer. Let's get back on this track.
So I had my 2-year degree and after I had been with him for like a year, I decided I want to go back to school and I wanted to go back to be a drug and alcohol counselor. So I go back to school and I got my 4-year degree and it was general studies because that was the fastest way to do it with a minor in substance abuse studies. And so you have to get a master's degree to become a therapist. And so I applied to this master's program and they denied me.
Okay.
And I just remember being like so crushed, which I didn't have all the classes I needed and it was going to take at least another year, maybe two to get all the classes. And I just remember being like, I'm going to be working here forever. Like, I'm never going to be able to phase up and make more than $5 an hour is what it felt. I mean, it was $8, but still. And so, you know, I had always had this dream that I wanted to be a lawyer. Like,
oh, you did? Like mm-hmm. deep down growing up and stuff.
It was not like super little, but when I was 18, 19, when I went and got my 2-year degree and I was sober for those couple years.
Okay.
Yeah, I got my 2-year degree in translating and interpreting Spanish with a legal emphasis because I was like, I'm going to be an immigration lawyer.
Oh,
you know, that would be fun. I had a lot of friends who were Hispanic and I just saw some of the troubles they went through. And I was like, you know, I want to help people like that. And then I started doing pain pills, and the story of my life is, and then I got high and all those dreams kind of went to the wayside, you know? So when they didn't let me in this master's program to become a therapist, I called my husband. I'm like, what if I went to law school? Do you think they'll let me in law school? And he was like, I don't know, but I think that'd be really cool if you did. So I call my mom, cause you know, my husband will sometimes like hype me up, but my mom will shoot me straight. She'll be like, oh, hell no.
Mine does too. My husband is my biggest fan, yes, which I love. And I feel like for some people we really need, because I'm like really hard on myself, and he'll tell me when I'm wrong. But for the most part, anything I show him, any outfit or my hair or anything, he's like, that looks really good. That looks great. Yeah. Like, yeah. You know what I mean? It's just, it's nice, yeah, to have. But wait a minute. Where did you meet your husband? When did you get married in this whole?
Oh, yeah. So he went to jail for like 6 or 7 months. They were trying to give him prison time. They ended up giving him 15 years on paper. So he gets out of jail in like June, maybe July. I get out of rehab at the end of June. And so we kind of meet going to meetings and stuff.
He's okay. So you met him in recovery?
Yeah.
Okay. You met him at a meeting. Okay. I love that you shared that, because I met my husband at a meeting too. And I don't know if you felt this way, but one of my biggest fears about getting sober was, how am I going to date anybody? Like, you get drinks when you go on a date. That's like literally what you do. So how am I ever going to meet anyone? But I met someone in recovery, and so did you. Oh, that's so, yeah, cool. Okay. Yeah. So you made me get married.
Yes. We got married when we were like 2 years sober, probably, which, okay, another thing is, they tell you don't date in the first year and all of that. And, you know, we didn't listen to that. And it was a wild ride, I will say that. But what attracted me to him was that he was so serious about his recovery. And so even though like we did break the rule or whatever, like he went to men's meetings and I went to women's meetings, and he did his stuff with his sponsor and I did my stuff with my sponsor, and you know, we really did take it serious. Obviously, we went to meetings together too, and we went to conferences and stuff. But yeah, you know, we really did put our recovery first. And so we got married a couple years in. And before law school, his son moved in with us. So his son was like 11 or 12 at the time. And we moved to Moore, Oklahoma, which is like just outside of Oklahoma City, because his son lived here with his grandparents. And we wanted him to like get to come stay the night. And like, you know, like we could take him to school or something. Well, we bought this house in November, and he moved in before Christmas, and he was with us until last November. He moved out. He's 18 years old, moved out with his girlfriend.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, okay, he's been with us that whole time. Yeah. It was awesome. Yeah. And actually now that he's moved out, it's even better, because I'm not nagging him to clean his room and to do this, yeah, that, and the other. And like, yeah, he's turned in. I mean, he kind of went through a wild phase for a little bit, but then he got him this girlfriend, and like, he's had the same job for over a year. I mean, he just bought his own car without our help or his grandparents' help or anything. So
is that the brother of, I saw you just posted that super sweet TikTok that your husband's daughter made for you, saying that you're like her best friend and stuff?
Yes, I know.
Is that his sister?
Well, they have the same dad, my husband, but they have different moms.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Right.
So I'll get to Jazzy.
Yeah, I was going to say, we can get to that later. But okay, so you ask your husband, I want to go to law school, and he says, yes, great idea. Okay.
Yeah. So I call my mom, and she's like, I think it's an awesome idea. Like, you can do it. And so I spent the next year, I took off from school, and you have to take a test, you have to apply, you have to basically disclose every time you've been arrested, detained, questioned, convicted, evicted, fired from a job, kicked out of school. I mean, everything. But I had talked to some people, who were lawyers. I talked to the LSAT people who were like, I did like a LSAT prep class, and I talked to them, and they all were kind of like, there's no like rule in Oklahoma or law that says you can't be a lawyer if you have a past. So what they look for are people who can be ethical. So if you have a bunch of fraud charges, like that might be different.
Okay. So and you're allowed to take the bar with felonies.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. What they want to see is that you're not that person. Okay. Yeah. I spent the next year doing all this stuff, and there were two schools that were like close enough where I wouldn't have to like move or anything, you know, because at this point it's me and my husband and my son. So I apply to these two schools, and you can get online and like see stats. So like last year, 10 out of 10 people with your LSAT and your GPA, it got accepted, or, you know, 5 out of 10. So you have a 50% chance or whatever. And so one school had like a 50% chance. The other school had like a 95% chance. So I was like, hell yeah, I'm going to law school. At this time, I was working at a hair salon. And so the dean of the law school calls me, the one that I was going to get in. And she's like, she spent like 10 minutes. We love your application. We're so proud of you. You know, you've overcome all these things and you're the perfect candidate and blah, blah, blah. But we can't let you in law school because you're on probation. And we can't let anyone who's on active probation into law school. And so I was like crushed because that was 2019. I didn't get off probation until December of 2021, which meant that I wouldn't have been able to start law school until August of 2022. So that was like 3 years later, you know? So of course I call my husband, I call my mom, I'm crying. I'm like, you know, this is, I'm never going to get a job more than $5 an hour. Same cry I did before, you know? And they both were like, call your attorney, call your attorney. I mean, he's good, but he can't make them let me in law school.
Yeah.
So I call him and I'm crying and he's like, bring me everything. At that point, I was like 4 years sober. He's like, bring me everything good you've done. Inpatient, outpatient, all your volunteer work. Part of my sentence was 3 random drug tests a month for 2 years. So I had peed for 2 years straight. All those I passed. My undergrad degree, all that stuff. I take it to him. He takes it to the judge and the judge dismissed all my charges like a year and a half early. So I could go to law school.
Oh, it was a year and a half later and then you got to get in?
No, no, no. The judge dismissed him right then. I would have had to wait a year and a half, but he dismissed him right then.
Oh my God.
So I call the dean back and I'm like, guess what? I'm not on probation anymore. And she's like, eh, we're going to have a meeting. In the meantime, my attorney gives me a job. So I start working for him, answering phones. And she calls me back and a few days later and she said, we had a meeting and we took a vote and we decided we are going to let you in this year and we're going to give you a scholarship.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So that's, they let me in law school. Cool.
I know.
That's the kind of shit that I'm talking about in recovery. Like these weird little miracles where like, when you look at it through like the logic of us, of humans, it doesn't make any sense and it would never work. But like, once we're walking a path of recovery, we're like not walking a path of human logic anymore because like God or the universe or whatever you believe in, like rises up to meet you where you are and provides all of these opportunities that don't make any sense. And like, that's one of them. That's amazing. Did you do well on your LSATs? I have to ask. I don't even know what the score range is. Did you do good?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't like top of the class or anything, but yeah, did. I did good. But I did graduate 13 in my class.
Damn. Okay.
Yeah.
So you I was get into law school.
Yeah. In law school.
You a scholarship.
Yep. And I graduated in the top 10% of my class. I was number 13, which is kind of like taboo. You don't, in undergrad, we all shared our grades, but I guess in law school, it's like more competitive. And I don't know. I shared myself all the time because I worked really fucking hard to be here. And I don't care if y'all think I'm weird.
Yeah. Oh, so like you're not supposed to say that now anymore or anything like that?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. People like didn't talk openly about it. But
okay. Interesting.
I don't know.
Well, I think it's cool. So
thanks. Me too.
So when did you graduate law school? How long ago was that?
It was last year. So May 2022. And then I took the bar exam, which you study for like 2.5 months. And then it's a 2-day test. And then you find out at the beginning of September if you passed. And then I got sworn in on September 29th. So this Friday, I'll be an attorney for 1 year.
Oh my gosh. Wait, so you passed the bar the first time?
Yeah.
That's kind of hard to do too, right? Yeah. Don't you have to take it more than once sometimes?
So only 56% of my school passed.
Oh my gosh. Look at you. Look at what you did with your life. That's so incredible. So where do you work now? Like, are you at a law firm or where do you work now?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a law firm. It's actually just one. It's so crazy because I thought I was like, I want to do criminal. I want to do family. I want to do stuff where people like us are. I want to help people like us, blah, blah, blah. And I started working with my attorney and I worked with him all through law school for 3 years. And my goal, like in my head, the whole reason I went to law school was like, because he's older, he's in his 70s. Was like for when he retires that I would buy his firm and carry on the name. And he's like a big deal around here. And, you know, I got in there for 3 years and there was someone else in the office who was just so toxic. And it was kind of like crushing because it took me a long time to realize like what I had dreamed in my head was not reality. It was not ever going to be reality. And so I ended up walking away, which was a very hard thing to do. And then I went to an immigration firm for a little bit, which I was like, this is what I always wanted to do. This is perfect. I was only there for a couple months though. And just the vibe there was also not it. I mean, not that there was anything wrong. It was just like, they wanted you to be there from 8:30 to 5:30 every day, period, end of story. And I'm like, man, I got little kids and, you know, so anyways, I end up getting a call from another family friend. And it's this who is friends with my now boss. So my now boss is 37 years old. He just had his first kid. So he has like a newborn. And I mean, I had worked for these guys who like didn't even know what a cloud was, you know, like if you're going to work, you have to be at the office. And now my new boss is like, I don't care. Take your laptop and work in Italy if you want to. I don't care where you work from. I just need you to do the work. Pick up your daughter. If you want to go do parent teacher conference or volunteer at the school, go ahead. And, you know, so it's like oil and gas, mergers and acquisitions, corporate stuff. It's mostly transactional. I don't even really go to court, which is all stuff that I would have been like, ew, why would I do that? But it's turned out to be very interesting. My clients are not calling me in the middle of the night freaking out, needing me to get out of jail.
Yeah, totally.
The emotional toll is so much lower, right? Because like criminal, when you leave the office, I couldn't turn it off. You know, I was attached to these people.
Totally, totally.
So it's been like such a blessing that, I mean, it's one of those things, like you just said, if I get these things in my head and I'm like, this is how it's going to go and it's going to be perfect and I'm going to be a criminal attorney and I'm going to carry on the la la la. And then God brings something so random in my life. And I did, like, before I ended up taking that any job, I kept praying, like, God, put me wherever you want me. I don't care what it is. Just let me know. And so, yeah, he gives me this random job, something I never wanted to do, never thought I would want to do, totally not interesting. And it's been the most amazing blessing for me and my family.
Making that transition from like the thing that you thought you really, really wanted, like at that law firm, and then you had to like face that maybe this isn't what I'm going to be doing. That's a really hard thing for anybody to come to terms with, right? Like I owned a fitness studio for a while and I ended up selling it. And I still wonder sometimes if I made the right decision or whatever. Do you feel like being someone in recovery helped you process that decision and like move on and handle it better and like work with your sponsor on that? Like, do you feel it? Cause I feel like my recovery stuff helps me a lot. Like I have such an edge over people when I have to make life decisions like that. Would you say the same thing for you? Like your recovery, like helped you make that?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because I spent those 3 years, I mean, on the phone in the bathroom with my sponsor, like, I don't know what to do. And I did everything with this woman, from clean up my side of the street, totally apologize for everything I had done. Stay silent. Don't get involved. Mind your own business. Try to point things out in a like constructive way. I mean, yell and cuss and scream and threaten to quit. I mean, everything from like the most spiritual, in the bathroom on my knees with this prayer that my sponsor made me print out every single day, to like cussing her out, Street Sarah. I mean, and everything in between. And it just was, I mean, got to the point where it was like, you know, this is not what I want for myself.
But like having your sponsor give you those tools is something that we have that is so helpful. Like my sponsor is so helpful for me, like all during COVID. So owned a gym in California during COVID, and the restrictions were like really, they were really severe with gyms in this area. And like, I don't know how I would have made it without having my sponsor to talk to, like you said, giving me like prayers and ways of looking at things and ways of managing things. And I always like to bring people back to the idea that like recovery doesn't just serve us in the beginning. Of course it does, but it does forever, for like years to come in our life as well. You know, what about your recovery would you say has been like the most valuable to you to get you to 8 years? Like if you had to pick like one or two things, would it be sponsorship, step work? Like what has been the most valuable for you to sustain this longer term recovery period?
I think it's definitely been the relationships, whether that's with my sponsor or other women, friends, people who hold me accountable. Like you said, we have this edge because, I mean, this woman in this firm, she had major unhealed trauma, you know, and she didn't have a therapist or a sponsor or anyone to call. And so she was bleeding on me and everyone else, people who didn't cut her, you know? And so like, yeah, having those relationships and people to call. And then the other thing for me is volunteering, whether that's going into detox, rehab, or I sit on a couple nonprofit boards.
Okay.
Just giving back, getting out of my own head and making it where it's not about Sarah all the time.
Right. What do you think was the most important thing in your early recovery? Like 30, 60, 90 days. Like if someone is listening that is very early in recovery, what would you recommend for them to do? Or what helped you the most? Because like me, super long-term use at that level is very hard to stop, right? Obviously, as you know, but like you did and I did. What do you think helped you in the early days when you first got out? You were in sober living. You could have got dope, but you didn't.
I mean, I think like the most important part in the early days is to find your people. And I make a joke that like 12-step is like Mexican restaurants. There's authentic and then there's Tex-Mex and there's some that are bomb and some that suck. And yeah, there are going to be 12-step groups with people that are annoying and people that are judgmental and people that are hateful. And like, you just have to find your people. And then once you find your people, stop comparing yourself. Because that was my thing, was like, I was looking at people I went to high school with who had careers and children and all these things. And here I am in fucking sober living. I can't even get a job. And when I do get one, it's $8 an hour. Holy. I'm scrounging up change with my boyfriend at the time, to try to get a burger.
Yeah.
You know, and so-and-so is posting about being at her job for 10 years. And I'm like, you know, my life is over. I'm never going to be that. Or even comparing myself to people in recovery, right? So I'm getting 90 days and I can't, I don't know, whatever, find a job or whatever it is. And then so-and-so, she's got 60 days and she just got a raise at her job, you know? And I still catch myself doing that and saying things like, well, wow, at 8 years, I should blank. And it's like, there's no should, you know, like we're all on a different path. There's no should.
Okay. You are a lawyer and you own a home. What, and you're only 32 or 33. What could you possibly think you should still have? I got to be honest, because I'm 43 and not a lawyer, don't own a home. Yeah. And so I'm looking at you thinking like the whole comparison thing, not like I was comparing myself, you know, comparing myself to you. But if I did, you have like way more TikTok followers than I do, even though your shit got banned and you had to redo it. Why did your account get banned? And you have such a good attitude about it. Bro, I would be so angry. Didn't you have like 300,000 followers?
Yeah.
You had like a lot.
I didn't have three. I had over two, but
you had over two. You had a lot. And then I went looking for you one day and I was like, wait, where? I was going to ask you to be on the show. And I was like, oh my God, where is she? And then I saw the new one, which I thought maybe it was somebody just like imitating you and then posting your old stuff. And you know how that happens sometimes. And then I looked and the first one was like, your girl got banned, but you were so happy. Like you seemed peaceful about it. I don't know how you actually felt, but you seemed okay with it. I would have been really upset.
Well, at first I panicked. I really did. Cause I was like, okay, so I also need to tell you the story about my daughter. So let me tell you that real quick. I'm 1 year into law school. Okay. I know my husband has a little girl when we first meet, but she was born and him and the mom dated for like maybe a year. It was super toxic. It was kind of like I was saying earlier, like, not that there's anything wrong with mom or him. It was just like, you know, when you're in the worst part of your addiction, like when I moved the dope man in. I mean, they ended up having this baby. And so they dated for like a year. My husband goes to jail for a while. And then when he gets out, they have lost touch. He's in sober living, trying to get his life together. So anyways, we get married. I know he has this little girl. And I start telling him, once we have a home and our son has moved in and everything, I'm like, you know, you got to get a hold of her mom. Because we had started talking about having more kids. And I was like, I just can't imagine that we have these three kids and we have this amazing life. And this girl shows up when she's 20. And she's like, you know, you guys didn't even come look for me. What the hell? You knew what I was going through. And so my husband starts reaching out to her mom and they just kind of, I think mom was scared we were going to take her away. And I think my husband was scared we were going to have to take her away. And so they just kind of were, I mean, they talked, but they kind of avoided each other. And so I'm a year into law school. I'm 5 years sober and DHS calls and says that she's not in a safe place and we need to have a safety meeting. And so my husband and I show up to the safety meeting. And it's these two other people who are on drugs that she's been living with for several years and her mom. And there's like six caseworkers. And they pretty much said that she had an infection in her mouth and they sent her home from school and she just never came back.
Oh, no.
And so, and then the DHS people started doing their investigation. They couldn't find her at first. They end up finding her because she showed up at a forensic interview with some other kid who was being like forensically interviewed over being sexually assaulted, basically.
Oh, no.
So they're like, wait, what the hell? And we find out she's been living with these random tweakers in a camper in the middle of nowhere. And no one's taken her to the dentist. And yeah, it was just like she told the DHS worker, like, my mom doesn't do the white drugs. She only does the green drugs. And she's like 7 at this time. And so I immediately was like, we want her. We want her. She needs to live with us, you know. And so they came and looked at our house. And a week later, she moves in with us. And she was 7 at the time. And she, I remember opening the door that first day and she's like, hi, Sarah, my name's Jazzy. And she was just so beautiful, so full of life. Even after everything she had seen and been through, she'd never had adults who, you know, I never had adults who showed up for her. And so she's going to be 11 in November and she's been with us for almost 4 years now. And when she first got here, she was like a little wild animal. You know, she was in fight or flight. She didn't know who to trust. You know, she's told me stories about that. She knows where the orange needle goes right here in your arm and she knows what it smells like. And she's seen people do that. She knows the difference in sex and rape. And
oh my God.
To explain it to me. And she did, you know, she knew so many things that no little kid should know. And in first grade, her teacher thought that she moves in with us in the middle of kindergarten. Also the same week, the whole world shuts down for COVID.
Oh, that she came to your house.
Yes. So she moves in, the world shuts down for COVID. I get her in virtual kindergarten, which was a shit show. That summer, my husband relapses after 5 years. He goes to rehab. So now I'm a single mom in a pandemic in law school. So yeah, it was a crazy time. But man, that was in first grade. Her teacher thought she had ADD or ADHD. And so we went and got her tested. And it turned out she has an attachment disorder, which pretty much just means that like she didn't attach to either her parents properly. So like as a baby, the first thing we do when we come into the world is cry, and we expect someone to hold us and feed us and change us.
Oh my God.
Like, she didn't have that. And we don't realize, like, how much those things affect us, even as a little baby, you know?
Really? Oh my gosh.
And so, yeah, well, today she's thriving and she's beautiful and she's funny and she's my little best friend and I love her so much.
That video that she made.
I know.
Problem with that. You can talk to me or something like that. Yeah. Right?
Because yeah. She's the one who's been there from the very beginning and she's never let me down. And yeah.
Where is her mom? What's the status with her?
So another thing that I feel like came from like God and recovery, because like I'm the type of girl that's like, I'm not dealing with your baby mama. Absolutely not. Not one, much less two. No way, no how. But instead of being that way, like I've been able to, like with my son's mom, I mean, we're not best friends, but like I can call her, text her for anything. She's always been able, kind of been there for me. Like when my husband was in rehab, like I would be like, he's not listening or whatever. And she would help me out. So we let Jazzy go see her mom one time when she first moved in and it was not good. She came home and she immediately started crying. I'm like, what's wrong? She's like, I just want to stay the night with my mom. And I was like, I know, babe, but you know, like you can't, at least you got to see her. And she's like, no, I didn't. Cause she was locked in the room the whole time by herself. And I was like, oh, absolutely not. So we went no contact for several years. And then a little over a year ago, mom went to treatment. And so the amazing thing though, that I was saying that recovery gave me was like, I get to be a champion for my daughter's mom. So every night for 3 years, we prayed that mom would get sober and that she would make good choices. And instead of me like trashing her or, you know, talking shit about her to my daughter or whatever, like I was able to explain to my daughter what addiction is and that she's sick. She's not bad. And that it doesn't mean she doesn't love her and that, you know, someday when she makes good choices, blah, blah, blah. And so mom went to treatment and then she moved into sober living. And at one point, like one of her family members called my husband and was like, she's about to get kicked out of sober living. She's like $500 behind and blah, blah. And I was like, well, we need to pay it. You know, my husband and I went and paid her sober living, which I don't usually tell people that, but I just feel like it's so important. You know, we spent all those years saying, if you ever need anything, call us. We'll do anything to help you get sober. And then when she calls for us to be like, oh, sorry, fuck you. Like, I could never look my daughter in the face and tell her that I went to bat for her and her mom. You know what I mean? If I didn't. And it wasn't like we couldn't afford it. You know, like we were in a place where we could afford it. And so we did. And so anyway, then her mom started coming to therapy with us. She's been coming with us for a few months. Jazzy was gone a lot this summer doing fun stuff. And so we kind of took a break. We're now getting back into it. Her mom's going to start coming to her games where she cheers and stuff. So like her and her mom haven't been one-on-one together yet, but like we're getting there slowly. And the therapist pretty much told her mom and I one day that, you know, the only person Jazzy has a secure connection with is me, or secure attachment with is me. And that like, I'm her safe person. And, you know, like I knew that obviously because, you know, I'm the one that's with her all day. I mean, my husband's here too, but there's nothing like a mom and a daughter, two women, you know. One of the first things she said when she moved in is, can we wear matching clothes? And I was like, yes.
Yeah. Yes, totally.
Yeah.
And it's fun because you're such a girl's girl too. So you get to like do her hair and do, you know what I mean? You would be like the coolest stepmom ever, you know? So how's your husband doing?
He's good. He's good. Okay. Since 2020, he's had a little bit of trouble a couple different times. But, you know, the good thing about my husband is that I see other people who go through this and their husbands just go and go and never stop. My husband kind of dabbles, but as soon as I find out, and I don't know, but I'm just like, no. Like, I married a sober man, and I now have children in my house who expect their parents to be sober. And so either you're going to live with us and be sober or you're not. And when I say that, he's always like, I'll do whatever. Like, he wants to be sober, you know? Yeah. So
have you found, because I have been in the same situation, have people been supportive for you or judgmental about that? Like, you stay.
The first time they were supportive, but I think now they start to get judgmental or, you know, after the first time. And I have had to tell his family, my family, just, you know, like this is our marriage. So I need you guys to butt out, you know?
Right. Totally. Yeah.
And luckily I get it. I've been there. And it would be different if, like I said, I found out and he was like, well, F you, I'm not doing anything. Okay, then.
But he tries.
Yeah. But as soon as I find out, he usually is like relieved because he's like, oh my God, I'm tired. I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah, totally.
And then he'll go to treatment or he'll go to detox or something and he'll get back on track. And
Yeah.
So
yeah, I know a lot about that situation as well. Very similar for me. So your life today is that you're a lawyer and daughter lives with you guys. And like, you having 8.5 years, because I've seen all your mugshots, you know, and it's like the complete turnaround from like junkie to lawyer. You know what I mean? It's like the low to the high. What inspired you to start talking about it on TikTok? When did you start your TikTok journey?
So I posted, I got on TikTok because my husband was doing dances and stuff and I just wanted to see them. Okay. And I posted a couple things. One of my videos, it was just a stupid video where he had left like biscuits and butter and stuff on the counter. And I used that like, oh no.
Yeah.
Oh no. And yeah. It was like on the floor and I panned to the counter and it's like, the joke was like, he left the stuff out. 120,000 people saw it and all of them were like talking shit. And they were like, this is so stupid. You're allowed to leave butter out. At least he made you biscuits. And then I was like, oh my God, okay. And then so he went to rehab in 2020. And then it was like, I think like April, May, 2021, things got way better. He and I started going to therapy. We were like super close. I was so grateful. And so I made a video then talking about how we met in early recovery. His kids moved in. I went to law school. And then he relapsed. And I remember what I said was, you know, but God will restore anything if you're willing to put in the work. And today everything's better and blah. I mean, that video blew up. Like over a million people saw it.
Okay. Okay.
And so I started to slowly talk about things. Like there's some things like my butt cheek that I just recently started talking about. And it's nerve wracking because like my boss knows I have TikTok. I don't think he's ever looked at it because he's just not into it. But like, I'm so nervous that like other lawyers are going to see it or people that we work on cases with or, you know, but at the end of the day, like I'm human. And I think, I mean, I say this all the time. Number one, I do it for the girl who's scrolling TikTok, who feels like she's never going to get sober.
Yes.
Who thinks, or maybe she did get sober and she relapsed, or, you know, maybe she is newly sober and feels like her life is, she's going to be working $8 an hour forever or whatever. Like, that's the person I want to reach. And I also call myself a drug addict or an alcoholic or a low bottom junkie.
Yeah.
People get really pissy about that. And I'm like, I do that for the same reason. Number one, like that's just what we call each other in 12 steps. Right. It's not a big deal.
I think it's dangerous to water down that language personally.
I agree.
It's what I think, but yeah.
I agree. And I don't think it's degrading. People say it's degrading or it like adds to the stigma or whatever. I mean, the truth of the matter is I have a disease and it's called addiction. And no matter if I'm getting high today or not, I'm going to have that disease. And so, you know, when I call myself those things, it helps other people in recovery to relate and it helps the new girl or the girl who's not sober yet or whatever to relate. And then the other side, like that's the main goal for me. But then the other side is like, I want friends and family to understand addiction a little bit better.
Yeah.
Okay. To know that, you know, just because I get it, like to this day, when there's people that I love who are lying and cheating and stealing, it's frustrating, you know, but to just say, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, or if you wanted to quit, you would, or it's a choice. It's not a disease. You know, that's not helpful. It's not helpful to you. It's not helpful to the addict. It's not helpful to society, you know?
Right. No, I would have loved to have seen you when I was using, because I felt like, you know, like the lowest person on earth. And I would love to have seen you, like beautiful lawyer, actually got out of it. That's why I do it too. Do you know what I mean? Because I'm like, well, I would have liked to have seen me talking about it, you know? Okay, last couple of questions, then I'm gonna let you go. Okay. What surgery did you do for your booty? How did you fix it? Did you do filler?
So it's gonna be 3 surgeries. So I had a scar that was like this big, softball size, on my hip. And that was all skin graft skin, which is... the goal is to put fat there, but if you put fat on skin graft skin, it's not really going to take it because it's not like healthy. So the first surgery, we like tried to make it as small as possible. So it went from like this much skin graft skin to like a golf ball size skin graft skin probably.
Okay.
So we're letting that heal and then we're going to go back in and try to get rid of the golf ball. And so it's just all my healthy skin or as much as possible. And once that heals, we will move fat from other places to try to even it out.
Okay.
So there'll always be a scar there, but at least in pants and stuff, it'll look more even.
Right. Yeah.
And my doctor was like, you know, we could try to do it all at once. It would be a major surgery. You would be out for months, major pain meds, or we could do several small surgeries. And I thought he was overreacting when he said it's not that big of a deal. But I mean, he gave me medicine in my IV the day of surgery. He gave me 10 Percocet 5 milligrams total. I only took 3 of them the next day. And I just took Tylenol after that. I mean, it really was like very minimal pain. More than anything, it's like feels like a bruise or just kind of annoying, you know, but
yeah. So, were you self-conscious when you met your husband and you had to tell him that you had, I mean, you had to have been.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
I mean, you just can't do anything about it, I guess. But like I have a scar from picking where it's like white and you can't do anything about hypopigmented skin. And I hate it. I'm so embarrassed about it, even in front of my husband to this day. And it's like, of all the things I got away with during that time.
Yeah.
No big deal. But still, yeah. It's like hard, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And recently my husband said something about, you know, like, I've always been an ass man, like a booty guy. And I was like, oh, I never knew that. And then you marry a girl with half an ass. Like, yeah. What? But I try to think about, oh, that's what, okay, two things. Number one, I try to think about like how grateful I am, because if I would have done it in my arm or anywhere else, I don't know if I'd be alive, but I would have had like a major deformity, you know?
Right.
Like this is the only place on my body I had enough skin to take it in it and like be okay, you know?
That's
and
true.
No one sees my ass cheek really, you know?
That's
so
true.
I mean, I can't wear a swimsuit. Outside of a swimsuit, I still wear one. I just wear shorts over it, you know?
Right, yeah.
It's like a minor, I mean, it could have been much worse. And then I was going to say this about, or we were talking about it a minute ago, about my daughter. She comes in, why I got banned. My daughter comes in, we're on live. I walk away for a few minutes. And when I come back, it shuts it down and says we're under 13. And then before it lets me appeal, it totally kicks me out of the app.
Oh, no.
So I can't even appeal. So I start emailing TikTok over and over and over and saying that, like, what the hell? And then they email me back and said, well, you need to go in app and appeal. And I'm like, I can't go in app. And they're like, send us a video of you in the app trying to appeal. So I send them a screen recording of me trying to get in using phone number, password, email. And it kept saying account suspended. And so anyway, the booty cheek and the TikTok thing, I really try. I mean, everything in general, I try so hard to be like positive Patty, because, you know, the one thing that's changed my life more than anything else, I think, is gratitude. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like at first I panicked, all those videos of me becoming a lawyer, all those videos of Jazzy moving in and seeing her mom and her and I growing together, like I lost all of that. And so, yeah, I panicked. But then I had to take a step back and be like, I have an amazing job. My family is safe. My home is safe. Like, if I'm meant to be on TikTok and have these people following me, then I will.
Yeah.
And TikTok can't stop that. And so,
yeah,
that's the vibe. I guess the same vibe as the do it scared, which I was going to say that to on one of your questions.
Say that again on your own, because I really like that. Well, because what I'm assuming, because I always ask people, like, in general, are you grateful? Because the other reason I don't dislike the addict word is I'm super happy that I was an addict. I'm super duper proud that I was an addict. That's the best thing about me. The best thing about me is that I was a homeless heroin addict and I'm not anymore. All the things that happened, not even the recovery part, the addict part too. I got so much out of all of that and I didn't used to feel that way. Is that how you feel as well?
100%. I feel like everything good in my life came from being a drug addict. The only thing I would change is the people I hurt, like hurting my mom. But I said this already a little bit, that I went from being an entitled, spoiled, hateful, mean girl. I never would have stopped being those things if God wouldn't have humbled me and I would have been a homeless heroin addict, like you said. You know, like everything good I have, the awareness, the wanting to grow and go to therapy and like be a better person and encourage other women and love people and love myself. I never, looking in the mirror and loving myself, even with half an ass cheek, like there's no way I could have done that without going through everything I went through. So I say this, you know, everything I have, everything good I have came from my addiction. Also, everything good I have, I did scared. You know, I get in my head, I think we all do, about like, well, that's such a terrifying decision. Oh my God, I can't. What do I do? What do I do? You do it scared. You know, everything good in my life, I got sober scared. I got married scared. I went to law school scared. My kids moved in scared. My husband is starting a business scared. You know, I share this stuff on TikTok scared. I come on these podcasts scared. Like everything good in my life, I did scared. So maybe someday I'll start admitting I'm scared. Right now, I just pretend I'm not and push through. But
well, but what you're doing is even more helpful to other people. Do you know what I mean? You're telling them after the fact. And I love that philosophy that like, okay, do it scared, but also look back. And is there evidence in your life that when you did it scared, something really good was on the other side? So does it stand to reason that that's happening again? You know, I love that. That's like one of my big things too, that I do. I teach fitness and I always tell people like, it's one thing for me to like hype them up with my words. It's another for me to direct them to the evidence in their own life and past that will inspire them to take a choice moving forward, you know? And basically that's, you just gave the ability to do that, you know, like, did you do things scared? Probably, you know? So, well, thank you so much for your time. Yes. I was so looking forward to chatting with you. And I love that Brittany said in our interview, you went listen to it. She was like, do you know who Sarah Boo is? And you got to hear it. And then you like posted about it too. And then I found you too, which was awesome.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that we connected. So where can everybody, speaking of your TikTok, where can everybody connect with you if they want to follow you?
So Sarah Boo 72, there's no H on Sarah. So S-A-R-A-B-O-O, the number 7, the number 2. But now on TikTok, it's 2.0. So Sarah Boo 72, 2.0. Instagram is just Sarah Boo 72. And I think that's all the social media I have. So
okay,
come find me.
Well, I hope they reinstate your account, but you're already at like 100,000.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
Yes.
Which is another thing. I'm like, my old account was really stagnant. I mean, I hadn't had a video do well. I feel like once you get bigger on TikTok, they kind of just like shut you up. And then the newer accounts, they hype you up. So I've only been back for like a month and I already have half what I had before. So
I know. I was looking at that the other day because I've been at 54 forever.
Yeah.
And I was looking and I was like, damn. She's already, when I looked, she had like 19, you know, now it's 95. So obviously,
it's the butt cheek story.
The butt cheek
almost 4 million people have seen the butt cheek story, which is another thing. I'm like, damn, y'all couldn't have blown up a video or like had my hair and makeup done in a suit or something.
Or like getting your law degree or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, it's the butt cheek story. But like, that's what's relatable, you know? So, all right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really, really, really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.